All right, welcome to the Thursday noon call, everybody. Chris Alcido here. We are ready to go. We've been talking a little bit about buying subject to details while we're waiting on some questions here. So now that we've got some questions, let's get going. Do continue to get your questions in, and we will go from there. All right. So Tyler says, how do you find comparative market analysis? Is that through the MLS? So, yes, Tyler, basically, a CMA or a comparative market analysis is something you do or something somebody has to do. Let's kind of look at it. It's not an appraisal, but it is a valuation tool. Okay. So it's very similar to an appraisal. It's just done by somebody who's not certified as an appraiser. Okay. So that means it's done more formally, different documents. You don't even have to have a document to do an actual CMA. You can just come, you know, do your review and analysis work in MLS, come up with a value, and MLS has some things you can print out, and then you just manually kind of adjust your numbers and stuff. But a CMA, comparative market analysis, basically you get in MLS and you have a subject property. You say, okay, I've got this subject property, 123 Main Street. I want to know what it's worth. So you get into MLS and you start looking at all the sales comps that have happened around 123 Main Street. Okay. And you start figuring out, hey, this comp is a little bigger, but not in as good a condition. This comp's a little smaller, but in better condition. And through learning how to do a CMA, you learn how to adjust for all those different points and figure out, hey, a property like our subject, which is this size on this type of lot in this area, in this condition, needing this amount of work, it should be valued around X, right? And you do that based on comparing it to other things that have sold and adjusting those sales, right? So if we had all things being equal, and I've got two properties sitting next door to each other, and the left one is my subject property. Hey, I want to know what this one's worth. And the right one, okay, the property is next door. And I've actually had this happen, so it's actually not that uncommon. But it's right next door, so it's on an exact same size lot. It's the exact same floor plan. Maybe they have a different window design here and there or something like that, because builders usually in a cookie cutter neighborhood don't like to put exactly the same properties next to each other. That's why they push people to different lots, but, you know, same floor plan, you know, it looks pretty much the same from the outside. It's in the, you know, same, like I said, same lot. There's nothing in the backyard, no pool, just a plain lot, just grass and a fence. And then, the property, the subject property is in really good condition, but it needs new carpet and paint. Okay. Let's say it just needs cosmetics, right? Just carpet and paint. And the one on the right, the comp property that I'm looking at, let's say it sold for $200,000 and it sold a month ago. Okay. That would be a really good comp, because I can tell you if that sold for $100,000 and let's say it's 2,000 square feet. Okay. I can tell you that paint and carpet, that's going to cost me somewhere around $8,000 or $10,000 for 2,000 square feet. Okay. And so my subject property is worth, ARV in the same condition, same thing, 200,000. Take into account the repairs, it's going to be 10,000 in repairs. So now I can come up with my MAO or my maximum allowable offer based on my exit strategy. Okay. But I know that if I put $10,000 into that property, it'll be worth 200,000. Okay. So that's how you do a CMA, right? And then you figure out what you can get it for based on the leverage you have, and the, motivation for the seller, right? And how distressed they are with whatever situation is going on, this, that, and the other, right? If you were to buy that property as is retail, which, you know, would not be uncommon, right? If all it needs is paint and carpet, you could pretty easily put it on the market, show it, and, just take a little less for it. Somewhere in the 190 range, right? Because it's only 10,000 paint and carpet. Now, if a buyer goes in and sees that, they're going to say, yeah, it might be only 10, but it could be 20, right? I'll give you a 180 for it just in case. And that's the way buyers are, right? That's how we make money on a fix and flip, is we go in with the same thing. Hey, you know, I'll give you 180. I put 10 into it and I can sell it for 200. Now, I would never actually do that transaction because there's not enough margin in it, but you get the idea. Okay. So that's how you do, that's what a CMA is, Tyler. It's comparative market analysis. You do have to have MLS access to be able to do that. Now, that being said, let me show my screen again because I want to go to, let's see here. So if we go to, this is Big Dog Training, right? And sorry, let's go back to Kimberly's Corner right here. And then right here, MLS contract special topics. Okay, we're going to click on that. That's going to take us to this special topics calls and videos. Okay, so right here, MLS, where it says San Antonio, that's San Antonio MLS. MLS for everybody else. Okay, Austin, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth. This is essentially this MLS. This is CMA training. This is how to do a CMA. Okay. Shinoa walks through, training you on MLS and the way we do it. I mean, that's what a CMA is. A CMA is a comparative market analysis done in MLS. So when she says MLS training, it is also, you could call this CMA training. It is how to do a CMA, how to figure out what a property is worth. So this is definitely where you want to go. Okay. All right. Going to stop showing my screen there again. Let's see. Tyler says, week three homework wants us to cold call FSBOs. That's FSBOs. That's for sale by owners. Do we still go through the ultimate seller script with these people? So it depends, right? You can. What we want you doing is we want you calling FSBOs because we want you to start learning how to cold call, outbound call, and talk about real estate, right? And a lot of people are not comfortable at all, number one, talking about real estate, much less cold calling somebody to talk about real estate, something they may or may not know much about. So the exercise is to get comfortable calling people and talking to them, okay? Yes, you can go through the scripts or you can do some different things. In fact, I think, let's see, Tyler's next question says, in week three training, after you go through the ultimate seller script, you get to the close. The numbers close has you share the comparative market analysis with the client. When do you gather that information? So that would be a follow-up, Tyler, right? You probably wouldn't have that on an initial call, especially a cold call. You know, so on a call like that, you gauge the person's interest. If they're going, you know, I can actually, while I'm talking to them, just look up a tax value and come up with a pretty quick idea in about 2 minutes while I'm talking to them on the phone, while I'm researching that online. Okay. I can do a few things in MLS. I can do a few things online, come up with a value. Now you'll learn how to do that over time. In the meantime, your goal is to get an appointment, set an appointment. Okay. I'm not afraid to cold call somebody, figure out they have an interest and really want to sell, look up a quick value and work with them right there to put it under contract at a certain number and email them a contract to DocuSign. Okay. They'll DocuSign, email that back. But in that process, I'm also setting an appointment because I need to see the property, right? To verify the condition that they're telling me, in order to, for this contract to work. And lo and behold, they say, yep, just needs paint and carpet. And I go out there and it needs a whole lot more, right? So now we start the renegotiation process, right? Which is typical. So you know, yes, you can go through the numbers close. The numbers close is really something you would more typically use sitting down with somebody on a second or third appointment, talking to them to put something under contract, right? But you can absolutely do it on first contact. You just got to get more familiar with the flow of things, the process, and the tools you have to talk to people and use. When you talk about, sharing with them the CMA and the numbers and the comps and all this stuff, I do that often, but I'm very selective at what I tell them, right? At the point where I'm sharing that information with them, I'm pretty strategic about it, right? And just like any wholesaler, I'm picking realistic comps in their area that I can show them that, hey, this is what, you know, the properties are selling for. But when I'm talking to a seller, those comps are going to be in a range, right? And of course, I'm going to pick comps in the lower end of the range. Okay. I'm not going to lie to them and say, you know, if their property's worth 300,000, I'm not going to lie to them and tell them it's worth 100. Right. But I am going to pick the comps that support a lower number in the 300s than a higher number. Okay. But realistic comps that we can point back to. Let's see. Tyler says, I understand the purpose of doing cold calls for FSBOs, from the beginning of the big dog training, but there are some things we don't know yet. For example, we don't learn how to estimate repairs until module 5. Yep. True. Or learn about subject 2s until later as well. I feel we're at a disadvantage on these calls until we know what to ask and how to answer questions. So actually, Tyler, very perceptive. You are at a disadvantage, but guess what? Shocker. That is actually by design. Okay. We put you guys behind the eight ball on purpose. Okay. So what we want you to do, that's why I tell people, hey, for those of you that are just afraid to make a call, don't know, you know, what's what, that's okay. Just call people on Craigslist. Look up Craigslist, look up FSBOs for sale by owners, and I give people a script, right? And you can take this as well. You can all use this. So if you're new, just find FSBOs on Craigslist, call them up and say, hey, you know, my name's Tyler. I'm looking for a new rental property, or a rental property, or however you want to put it, right? I'm looking for a rental property. Saw your ad in Craigslist and thought it might suit my needs. Can you tell me about it? Right. And then you shut up and let them talk. Now they're going to do one of two things. They're either going to start talking and tell you everything you ever want to know about that property, or they're going to say, what do you want to know? And they're going to shut up and you have to talk. Okay. Either way, you're going to start learning how to talk to people about real estate and questions that you have, what to find, right? And you'll figure out, right? Hey, guess what? Your property on Craigslist is a 4,000 square foot, $650,000 property. Yeah, probably not a good rental. Okay. Or, it's a, 1,800 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage, perfect rental, right? Oh, well, your price is a little more than, what my typical 1% rent range is, right? Value, on a rental, your rents are typically 1% of the value. So if my property is worth, $180,000, I can typically get $1,800 a month, right? Give or take, might be 17, might be 19, but it's in that range, right? You're not going to have $180,000 property that you can only get $750 a month for. Okay, there's something wrong with that picture. By the same token, if I look up rents and I see that, hey, my max rent on a 3-bedroom, 2-bath property in this neighborhood is $1,400, there's no way this property should be worth $250, which is what you're asking, right? So these are some of the things that you will learn, you'll figure out. But what you can do is just call and just say, hey, I'm looking for a rental, saw your ad. I just wanted to talk to you about it, right? Because who cares if you blow it? Who cares if you mess up? You're not really looking for a property. You're looking to talk to people. Now, have I found deals on Craigslist? Absolutely have, right? Several subject twos, depending on the market and what's going on, but I've found several subject twos on Craigslist by calling some of these guys. And the other thing you'll learn is half of these people that put properties on Craigslist, they are, if you look in their retail condition and their retail price, then you'll very quickly find out this is a property I rehabbed. It's fully rehabbed, looks great, great condition, and, I've got it for sale, right, at a retail price. And you say, oh, great, so you're an investor. Guess what? I'm an investor also. I often have properties in this area and I wholesale those properties. Are you interested in being on my buyer's list? Right. So now you can get, you've talked to Craigslist, getting comfortable talking to people. If you can find a deal out there, great. The exercise is to get comfortable talking to folks. But there are deals to be had. And guess what? now you've satisfied another one of your homework requirements, which is talking to people about being on your buyer's list. How do you find other investors? Well, that's one of the other exercises I give people to find investors. Call Craigslist FSBOs. Most of them are investors. Okay. All right. Let's see here. Sonia says, what do you use for bookkeeping purposes? QuickBooks question mark, trying to do it myself until deals are flowing. So QuickBooks is typically the go-to. Honestly, you know, there are some other accounting software out there. If you want your bookkeeping and accounting to be, you know, FUBAR, let me handle it for you, right? Or let me give you advice on that. So this is actually a good time to let all you guys know that I am not a lawyer, attorney, a CPA, a financial planner, a bookkeeper, an accountant, excuse me, none of the such, okay? All this information is information that works for me and in my business. I know it to be accurate, but when it comes down to rubber meeting the road, do make sure you are getting, advice from licensed and legally qualified folks with regards to things like legal work and accounting and bookkeeping and stuff like that. Okay. So you should have, you know, you can still have, maybe a bookkeeper, Sonia, a bookkeeper could help you tremendously and they're pretty cheap, right? As opposed to an accountant. In fact, I would probably start with a bookkeeper before an accountant if you're trying to do it yourself, and go from there. But yeah, QuickBooks does seem to be the go-to software. Okay. Just to let you know, I will tell you, you know, if it's super simple, yeah, you can keep it on a spreadsheet, but that does get old really quick and difficult, right, for your accountant. So just keep that in mind. All right. Simon says, question one, do the big dogs have a Texas land trust template? They do not. Okay. Land trusts work great. Land trusts are not a proven entity in Texas. Now, that doesn't mean they don't exist. Doesn't mean you can't use them. Okay. But I'm going to direct you to an attorney if you want to talk about an actual land trust. Okay. Because chances are, if you do your entity structuring correctly in Texas, there's actually no need for a land trust. So talk to an attorney about that. But no, there is no template from the big dogs, at least for land trusts. Like I said, land trusts are not really recognized in Texas. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It's just like, LLCs, right? Series LLCs are not exactly, I mean, they exist here in Texas. They're not exactly proven in the hardcore courts yet. So there's some question about those, right? But that doesn't mean they don't work. Doesn't mean you're not protected, right? But again, talk to your entity structuring advisors and your attorneys on that stuff. Let's see. Question two from Simon. Says, real estate, does Texas require reporting the transfer of ownership? So it does require the reporting of the transfer of ownership only because a deed gets recorded from one entity to another, right? And that's public information. However, I think you may be talking about the amount of the transaction, and no, Texas is a non-disclosure state. Okay. So the amount of that transaction will not be disclosed. This is why in Texas, you cannot rely on Zillow or Redfin or all these other AVMs, right? Automated value models that use different algorithms to come up with different information, right? Granted, they use a lot of MLS data these days, and MLS is reported, right? But not all transactions are on MLS. So, they're trying to do the same thing as an automated CMA. It's called an AVM, automated value model. And that's what Zillow does, but it is not from actual data. It is from extrapolated data, right? So guessing at data, so to speak. So I think that's what you meant by that. All right. Let's see. Lloyd says, are subject tos and amps interchangeable terms? If not, what are the nuances between them? So actually they are not. interchangeable terms. Okay. Subject to means you're purchasing a property subject to a first lien mortgage. And AMPS stands for assignment of mortgage payment strategy. Okay. And the difference is this: when I'm doing a sub two, I'm buying that property. Okay. I am taking a property that somebody's willing to keep the loan in place. I'm going to buy it. They're going to deed the property to me. They're going to assign the mortgage to me, and I'm taking that subject to that first lien. Okay. In an AMPS, and I'm paying them whatever. Okay. I'm reinstating it, paying them nothing. I'm reinstating it and paying them $5,000, you know, reinstating it and paying them $50,000 because it's worth $500,000 and, you know, the loan's $300,000, whatever. Right? A million different ways to come up with that, with those analysis numbers. But in an AMPS transaction, assignment of mortgage payment strategy, I'm taking that same deal and I'm finding a different buyer for it. Not me, but a different buyer. And I'm assigning that mortgage payment to somebody else as a strategy to make money. Look at it that way, right? AMPS, assignment of mortgage payment strategy. So there may be no equity in this deal. Okay. This deal may be, you know, $150,000, mortgage. It's got a $15,000, reinstatement, and the whole thing is worth, you know, $160,000. Okay. So if the ARV is 160 and there's a 150 balance and 15 owed, that's 165. Right. So it's already $5,000 underwater. Well, I could still take that deal and market that and find a buyer who says, hey, I can't get a loan, but I make great money and I've got some money saved up. I'm happy to take that loan. Right. For a small fee. And I say, okay, great. Hey, buyer, I've got this property. It's 150 balance. It's going to cost you $20,000 to get into it. I take his $20,000. I take 15 of that and reinstate. I take $5,000 and put in my pocket. He pays the closing cost. Now he's got a mortgage for $150,000, right? That he couldn't have gotten otherwise because I assigned him that those mortgage payments from this other buyer. So I didn't take title. It went from that's an A to C transaction, right? Did not go to B, right? It's not an A to B, B to C. Which would have been a wrap. And I could have done it either way, but if there's no margin in it for, you know, no equity, then there's no really no margin for a wrap unless you want to hold it really long, long term. So that's the difference between a sub two and an AMPS. Sub two, you take title, and then if you sell it to a third party, that's a wrap. In an AMPS, you find a deal that has a sub two component, but you don't take title, you just sell it to a third party, okay? All right. Sonia says, and this is the last question, guys. So if you got questions, let us know. If not, I'm happy to give you a few minutes of your time back. But Sonia says, what things do you consider when deciding on assigning a contract to other buyers? Fix and flip, fix and rent, or wrap on a subject on sub two deals? Let's see. So what do you consider when deciding on assigning a contract? Well, if you're signing a contract, you're wholesaling a deal. So a fix and flip, if there's a good enough margin, I'll do a fix and flip. But here's the deal with a fix and flip. If I can do a fix and flip and get $20,000 out of it over 4 to 6 months, 4 to 5 months, you know, best case scenario, 4 months. Okay. Let's just call it 4 months. That's a small property. If I can get $20,000 out of it, but if I can take that contract and wholesale it, assign that contract and get 10, maybe I just do that, right? As opposed to taking 4 months and a lot of risk and putting out money and a bunch of time and effort for another $10,000, right? I just immediately flip that contract and take the 10 and run. Now, if it's a difference between only being able to wholesale it for a $10,000 profit, yet I believe I can make $30,000 by flipping it, then I'll flip it, right? But if the, you know, if you know, in a strong market, you can get pretty good pretty good numbers for wholesales. So that may take the flip equation out of it, right? Fix and rent. Okay. So a fix and rent is a long-term buy and hold. So yeah, I love to find my rentals through sub twos, right? Most of them are done that way. Not all, but most. And if I can do a sub two and rent, then yeah, that's a strategy, right? But I'm not assigning a contract for that either, right? I'm deciding that, hey, this property is a good property to rent. It's going to pay down. I'm going to build some equity in addition to having some cash flow every month, right? I look at the balance of all those and see what's what. Or wrapping it, right? And wrapping it means, hey, I'm going to take a subject to, I'm going to buy it, put it in my name, then I'm going to sell it to somebody else at a higher interest rate and higher price. That's the wrap. So I'm wrapping the underlying mortgage that is still subject to that first lien. I'm going to wrap that first lien mortgage with a larger mortgage and sell this property, right? A lot of nuances to that as well. But if there's, you know, if I can buy a property at 100 and sell it for 2, that's a great wrap, right? If I can get something at 3% interest and sell it for 10, that's a good wrap. Okay. So maybe I do that as opposed to cash flow on something like that and holding it myself long term, right? That way I don't have to deal with the real estate, the repairs and this, that, and the other, right? But you do have to deal with defaults and foreclosure if your buyer doesn't pay. All right, let's see. Toulouse says, memorandum of contract. I've seen some that specify lien amounts and others that only provide a contact info. Can you please describe the process after an MOC has been filed? What happens if a title company overlooks one of these? So if a title company overlooks one, that's a good question. You've got recourse to the property. You've got claim against the buyer that says you had an existing contract. Now you may have to go and force your hand and exercise that contract. However, if a memorandum of contract has been filed, a title company will not issue clear title. So that's what is what stops that from happening with a memorandum of contract. It's the title not being clear because there's an outstanding question as to your rights to purchase the property over the person closing on it, right? So when you put a property under contract, if you go down and file a memorandum of contract, the memorandum, it's a memo that says the attached contract is hereby put on notice to anybody trying to purchase this property that this contract is in first place, okay? And then the memorandum has to be notarized, right? Because a contract's not notarized, it can't be filed and recorded, but it can be attached to a document that is filed and recorded. So that's why we use a memorandum of contract, which is notarized, then filed and recorded to attach that contract to put title companies or anybody looking at the chain of title on notice that there is claim against that title. Right. Hey, I put a legally binding contract, in place. The seller refused to perform on that contract. I'm putting everybody on notice that I have the first right to this property. Right. And I'm pursuing remedy on that. Now, pursuing remedy may be just waiting until they have to sell to somebody else and pay you off to release that memorandum. OK, but that's what a memorandum does and how it works. That's the process. Once you file it, it's just part of the title search discovery. So, as far as a title company who closes over one of those, it depends, right? If your memorandum was 2 years old and you've never acted to perform, to force the seller to perform on the contract, you're going to have a weak argument. However, if your memorandum contract is, just a few months old, which is much more the case because somebody will put a deal under contract with you and then another investor will come along and say, hey, well, I'll give you $10,000 more than he did. And they say, okay, great, let's do it. Well, that's what a memorandum contract's for. Okay. You got this property under contract at $90,000. He now is putting it under contract at $100,000 with somebody else and not going to close with you. So your memorandum of contract says, hey, you close with me or you got to pay me off to release this because I'm going to keep your title cloud cloud it as long as I can based on that information. Okay. So that's kind of how a memorandum contract works. Let's see. You're very welcome, Tolu. Happy New Year to you. Excellent, Sonia. Glad you learned something. Sonia's got a question. Do you use a memorandum of contract on every deal? Great question. I know some investors that do. Personally, I do not, but I usually have a pretty good feel for my seller, and I do it based on intuition or gut feel. Okay. So if I know I got a really good deal and a lot, even if I've got a good rapport with the seller, if I got a really good deal and I know a lot of investors are going to be pursuing this seller and it's going to be easy for them to offer more, yeah, I'll probably put a memorandum down. Okay. Or if after I put a deal under contract, I start getting grief or my seller starts, you know, questioning things or backing out or trying to do something, yeah, I'll put a memorandum in place pretty quick. Okay. But if I've got like a kind of off market deal that's not in the public eye, like a foreclosure, and I've got a good rapport with the seller and I know they're not working with anybody else, I usually don't. And there are a lot of tricks with a memorandum of contract. For example, I only record certain pages of the contract itself because you have to pay for every page of recording. So when you record a complete 11-page contract plus the memorandum, 12 pages, I think it's 12 pages, maybe 11, I don't know. But the whole thing's 12 pages. I mean, that's going to cost you, you know, 80, 90 bucks, right? So I usually only file the first page of the contract, the terms page, the signature page, and a few select pages like that, right? That kind of tell the story of that contract and that I own it, first right of refusal, so to speak. And so it doesn't cost me as much. It costs me about 30, 40 bucks to file like that way. So just some things like that, but you know, it really just depends. But better safe than sorry, I will tell you that. And I have seen a lot of investors file just as a matter of their process on every deal they do. Okay. All right. Well, that is it. We are out of questions and we're also out of time, right at 1 o'clock. So with that, let me just do one more thing here. If you guys, let me show my screen. If you guys have not seen it, bigdogcalendar.com is where it is at. Right here is all our workshops. Take a note right here, Big Dog Foreclosure Field Trips. That's me. And we are doing a field trip. Let's see, who should attend? Yep, several years ago, that's me. In the picture several years ago, though. And this is January 7th. We're at the Tarrant County Courthouse. So jump on there and register for that today. But you can sign up for all these workshops. So go through, read the descriptions. It'll tell you whether you need to go or not and all that good stuff. And then here's the calendar piece. Okay, so nothing the rest of this week. Sorry, I hear sirens. I thought it was music at first. Let's see, we've got, this is the field trip. We've got Austin Rhea on Tuesday, Houston Rhea on Wednesday. We've got Dallas Rhea on Thursday. Holy cow, Phil and Shadow are so busy next week. Dallas Rhea Thursday, and then take a special note. Alan Sesker is doing a lunch and learn, right? A happy hour lunch and learn at BJ's restaurant in Addison, right? Prior to the Dallas Rhea. So be a great opportunity to go to that. I was going to go, but I've got to run the call for Shanoa next week also, since she's traveling into DFW and the Sprinter van has trouble with connection. So with that, guys, be sure and check out the calendar because it does tell exactly where the location is. We do change those sometimes, and the calendar is always updated, okay? So with that, guys, thanks for joining. Hope you guys have had a wonderful holiday, a Merry Christmas, and a happy, safe New Year. And we'll see you all out at your local RIAs. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.